everyone, and welcome to the Priceless Podcast. My name is Michael Sechen. I'm the podcast host. This podcast is made in partnership with the European Forum of LGBT Christian Groups. Today we bring something different for you. The European Forum has a working group that is working with the Catholic Church. They continue their work in support of visibility of LGBTI plus Catholics during the Synod, where Pope Francis is trying to bring the Church closer to the people. Because of that, they work together with global partners to collect synodal experiences to ensure that voices of LGBTI plus persons are being heard in this historic process in the global Catholic Church. For this reason, they organize 4 different webinars where they have different speakers who talk about their experiences, about their knowledge and their expertise. We wanted to bring these webinars to you so you can listen to them if you weren't able to be present. Enjoy the first part, and the other 4 are gonna come later.
We're delighted that we have some wonderful speakers for this opening webinar today. They exemplify the diversity of our very rich and diverse church. And so without further ado, I will introduce our first speaker, Dr. James Hanvey. Dr. James Hanvey is a Jesuit priest. He has been head of the theology department at Heathrop College here in London and director of its Institute for Religion, Ethics and Public Life. Until his more recent appointment to the General Curia of the Society of Jesus in Rome as Secretary for the Service of Faith, he was Master of Campion Hall in the University of Oxford. He has also been a member and co-chair of the Commission for the Spirituality for Synodality as part of the Synod Secretariat, which was part of the preparation for the Synod on Synodality. And James has also been involved, I think, with the Theology Commission of the Synod Secretariat. So he comes and shares with us enormous experience. And we look forward to hearing James on, does the Synod continue to be relevant? How do we keep up the synodal dynamic? Thank you, James.
Thanks very much, Martin, and greetings from Rome. It's a joy to be with you. And that question, how does the Synod continue to be relevant? And I think actually an event like this begins to answer that question, because here we all are, here we're reflecting on it, and we're using our experiences with a desire to continue it and to deepen it. If I had to say, in what ways does it continue? I think the first thing has been the experience of participation. It's a new experience of coming into the church and being able to speak and having our voice heard. And one of the things that impressed me most in the early part of the preparations was when each of the national synods were reporting, one of the things that many of them made a big effort to do was not just speak to the people that we know and the people that are already engaged, but a really genuine attempt to go out to the peripheries. And that meant actually finding new ways of communicating. I was particularly impressed with the Australian church that actually translated into a different sort of language or into a simpler English to reach the Aboriginal people. So this is a church which is suddenly becoming aware of its peripheries. Of course, I would want to add to that, it's not just the peripheries outside the church, it's also the peripheries within the church. And it's a way of opening that up and suddenly giving people their voice. So it's participation at that level. It's also participation that if you look at the synthesis document, if you look at the range of people attending that, the engagement of lay men and women at that level, that's unique and that's new as direct members of that discussion, not simply there as advisors or experts. The other dimension of that, of course, is also the ways in which we are all invited then to take co-responsibility. If you notice, one of the key lines running through the synthesis document is this idea of co-responsibility. That means that we, in order to have co-responsibility, we all have to participate. And it's so one of the underlying questions, which should be one of the areas for investigation by the different study groups, well, how does that actually play out within the structures of the church? And what changes of attitude does that require on everybody's part? So that idea that we are all co-responsible, which of course takes us right the way back to our baptismal reality, because when we're baptized, we're all incorporated into the church, but we also have responsibility for the church and for the message of Christ in the world. I think another idea of how this begins to become relevant, in fact, in a way, it's all about relevancy, because right from the very beginning of his pontificate with Evangelii Gaudium, the Pope is very clear of emphasizing the missionary dimension of the church, the missionary vocation of the church. And so all of this is that he uses very often the phrase that we are a church in Ushka, a church going out, a church not looking in, but a church going out to the world. But once you go out to the world, in what way do you go out? And I think that's one of the fundamental underlying questions that's there in the Synod, but it's also a question that is around Francis's own ministry as Pope. If you notice, it's not going out as the predominant teacher, that we have all the answers. It's once we go out with a different disposition. We go out with a degree of humility, with a degree of openness, and also a receptiveness to learn and to hear from the different cultures, from the different groups, from the different situations. So this is a different dynamic. And it's essential. It's not against the church's role as teacher. In fact, it's a prerequisite of the role as teacher, because as any of us know who are teachers, if you're going to be a successful teacher, you have to start from where your students are. You have to listen to them, to what their real concerns is. And sometimes you have to learn their language. So that's another dimension, I would say. But the mission is not just out to the world. I would say the mission is also interior. It's interior to the very life of the church. So that if we're going to have a genuinely strong, vibrant mission, we also have to look at ourselves. And that means that we're committed to conversion, which is one of the key lines in the whole synodal process, and renewal. So all of those dynamics are in play. It may feel a bit messy. It may look uncertain. And I think that's okay, because I think this is a church that is also a learning church. It's a church that has to experiment and discover what works, what doesn't work, what it gets wrong, what it's because it's searching. Now, what does that tell us about where we are? I was always surprised with the preparatory documents that the Synod produced, that it somehow never started with the obvious text from Scripture, which was always obvious to me, which was the Council of Jerusalem. It mentioned other texts, other very useful texts. But the Council of Jerusalem is absolutely critical for understanding where we are now, partly to understand the continuity that we have, that this is not, this synod approach is not a big innovation. It's quite a profound development. Because if you actually look at the Council of Jerusalem at the beginning of Acts, what's very clear is Peter and Paul are not there in control. They're there as witnesses to what the Spirit is doing. And it's the Spirit that's leading them beyond where they would feel they could legitimately go. And I think that's really important. And they're not threatened by the Spirit. They're willing to attend and they're willing to testify to where the Spirit is leading. Then it is the church's job, the council's job, to debate this. And it's hotly debated and it goes on being debated even after the decision to go to the Gentiles. But if you look at what happens, there is a consensus achieved. It seems good to us and to the Holy Spirit. And that's not an accidental phrase. That's saying we recognize the Spirit and we understand that the Spirit is moving us and we are in agreement with it. We have the freedom to follow this Spirit. Then that other little phrase, which is really quite critical, is then they set the minimal conditions. And the point about the minimal conditions is it allows everybody to sit at the same table. Because the minimal conditions are saying you need Gentile Christians and Jewish Christians can now sit together. So there's a reconciliation, there's a healing, there's a new sense of how we are as community. So I want to put that right at the center because I think that's our experience at the moment. And of course, in that experience, the deeper shifts are changes of culture that are always happening. Then one of the other big changes going on is what I would call from an ultramontanist church to a synodal church. The ultramontanist model of the church is very, very successful. Most of us were brought up in it. Most of us came to love it and respect it at huge strengths. But the fundamental premise of the ultramontanist church was you had a hierarchical church whose job was to teach and to govern, and you had the laity whose principal work was to obey, to follow. Now what we have is we have a synodal church in which everyone has a voice. It's the Spirit that's leading, and therefore we must be attentive to the Spirit. That doesn't demolish or annul the hierarchical system, but it begins to change the way in which that has to operate. It also begins to change the way in which we, as members of the church, have to attend and have to open ourselves. So there's a whole range of changes, subtle and not so subtle cultural changes that we're all involved in. So the other thing that has emerged there, and I think we still have a lot of work to do on it, is the whole concept of the sensus fidelium. And that's a fundamental premise of the synodal process. Because the sensus fidelium is really begins to focus, it comes up to the surface. It's been there for really since the beginning, but it begins to come up to the surface in Vatican II. But I don't think we've done enough theological work on it. And I don't think we've really acknowledged our experience of it. To put it sort of very simply, the premise of the sensus fidelium is that by virtue of our baptism, by virtue of our confirmation, by virtue of our participation in the sacramental life of the church and in the prayer life, the liturgical life of the church, living as a Christian, we are guided again and attuned to the Holy Spirit. In other words, every Christian, by a sort of habitus, you don't have to be an intellectual, you don't have to have had a theological formation. By living this life and living in the community, you get a sort of instinct for north, like a compass needle. You get an instinct for what is right and what is true. Now, if that's the case, then that also means that everyone in the church has that gift, has that instinct, by virtue of living this life. And that means that their experience, the experience of people, is a theological resource for the church. We know from our ordinary life that we gain a wisdom from just living and doing. And it's this wisdom, this Christian wisdom of a Christian life, that I would maintain every single person in the church has. And it's how do we use that? How do we honor that experience? How do we honor the authenticity of that experience? Even though we may never have heard that voice before, even though it may be uncomfortable for us, it's still there to be heard. Because that's also the voice of the Spirit speaking through the lives of people over their time and over their lives and over history. Because there's a tradition in this as well. Tradition is not a dead voice, it's a living voice. And so in a funny sort of way, we begin to discover that the church is perhaps the deepest community of conversation, because it listens to the voices of all those who have kept faith from the past, that dynamic tradition. It also looks to the future, and also it's rooted in the present. Those are some of the key elements that I would select, and we've only begun to touch on all of that. The other side of that is I think we're coming at a new moment, certainly for the church in Europe. None of us can come with a sort of sense that we have all the answers anymore. We come as a wounded church. And that's important to recognize that. So we come out of a new space for the church, recognizing having to deal with that woundedness, with that vulnerability. we also come out of a church in which itself is being marginalized within our culture. And so we're having to learn to speak and to live from a new position, from a new space. And I think that's a gift as well as a challenge. And I think it opens up another way of coming and listening and approaching to our culture. And I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. So within all of that, one of the key things is the other second part of my question, as Martin mentioned, was how do we continue this? Well, we're continuing it by meeting and reflecting and discussing and listening to one another and attending to the realities of the church in which we live and where we find ourselves culturally. One of the important things that the Pope has said in when he's presenting the working paper for this in-between period between 2023 and 2024, is he said that we have to remember it's about the synodality. It's a synod on the synod, on synodality. And that means it's about an experience, and therefore it's also about a process. And it's about us being willing to live in this process and living, willing to say, we haven't got the whole road mapped out. That's why we need to listen. That's why we need to attend to one another. That's why we need to learn. So I would suggest then this is a new space, this living with this process in which we're all involved. Also, I think part of it, and I think it surfaced, at least it seemed to surface for me on the synod, on the assembly floor, and that was a new understanding of what it is to be Catholic. Because not only did we have to learn to listen and to enter into this process, but we also had to rethink what I think intuitively what we all thought of as Catholic, because we've been used to thinking of one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, and that manifested in the structure in which there was a uniform liturgy, in which there was a uniform teaching and a uniform hierarchy. Suddenly in the synod, we began to hear the different cultural voices, the different experiences of Catholics throughout the world, and how, although we might have the one teaching, how that teaching is received, how it's understood in different ways, and how it has to be lived in different ways. I think that's a profound enrichment of what it is to be Catholic, because it's actually looking, I think, towards a deeper Trinitarian experience, because it's seeing the difference is not a threat, it's a gift. And how do we grow and listen through the differences that are there? And also, the big challenge is not to convert our differences into divisions. And because once we make that move, then there's no conversation. It becomes a power struggle. Now, again, I think we're all engaged in learning how to do that and having to unlearn old habits and old ways of being. So those would be some of the things that I would want to identify there. And I think the synthesis document begins to model that to some extent. I know different voices and different constituencies were unhappy with the synthesis. It's a synthesis. It's not a minute. Not everybody's voice is there. It's actually trying to capture something, but capture it so that it moves forward. And what I liked about it was the way in which it was able to identify convergences, but also then work in progress. And I think that's a good model for us all, wherever we are. First of all, to say, what is it that we can actually sense in one another? We might have a different way of expressing it, but there's a convergence of the spirit here. And then genuinely, honestly to say, this needs to be resolved. This is painful. We haven't got very far in this, etc. So I think that's a very good way of working. I'm going to conclude by answering a question you sort of half asked, and I'm just going to introduce it very quickly, because I think it's critical in all of this. And that's the whole question of conversation in the spirit. Because I think another big discovery, and this is again something we all are in the business of learning, even Jesuits are in the business of learning it, and that's what is this conversation in the spirit? And it's actually, first premise is what I've started with, the Holy Spirit is actually active amongst us. We've all had the experience of when somebody is really listening to us, we know that they're present to us, and we're present to them. They're not trying to reinterpret us. They're not trying to move us in one way. They're actually attentive to us and listening to us. Now, in this conversation in the spirit, we're listening not just in that degree of openness and intensity to the person. We're listening to the spirit moving in the person. And then that's the first round, really, of it. The second round is listening to the spirit moving amongst us. It's listening under that surface. That requires a degree of freedom because I come in with my agendas, I come in with my prejudices. I have to unhear myself. And I have to get over my sense of being threatened or my sense of fear to say, okay, what is the spirit moving and saying amongst us? And it means that I don't have the monopoly of the spirit. Somebody else may have that, but they speak truly. And it's the ability to recognize. Also the honesty of saying, this makes me feel uncomfortable, because that's how the spirit works, not just through our agreements, but through our tensions, through our disagreements. So we shouldn't be afraid of those, because we're actually all involved in this search. And the third movement is to say, standing back from all of that, the tensions, the disagreements, the deepening, okay, let me take time just to reflect a little bit and then say, okay, where is the spirit surfacing now? Where is the spirit present, and where is the spirit summoning us? I think that I think very briefly I've captured that movement, but it takes a lot of unlearning, because most of us go in with our experience of our businesses. We want an agenda, we want outcomes, we want to see the minutes, we want to do our, and we also come from a political background. We're all used to getting our point across and all the rest of it. So a lot of this is a deep asceticism, a charity, if you like, a love of the church and a love of the people I'm with, to stand back and say, no, I want to unlearn this because I want to hear you. And I really want to hear what the Spirit is saying. So that's how I would say that we're all involved in that. And I think it takes a lot of learning. So that's where we are, I think, at the moment. I'll finish on this note. Consolation, desolation, two great Jesuit words. Consolation isn't the same as depression, although it can feel like that. But consolation is when we really feel, I'm not getting anywhere. This is a mess, or there's a block here, or I just want to give up. So a couple of years ago, I was reading Karl Rahner's book, The Shape of the Future Church. And I was preparing to give some lectures on ecclesiology. And as I was reading it, I was getting more and more desolate, maybe even depressed, because these were talks that he gave at the 1971 German Synod. And lo and behold, they were all the topics that we are dealing with today, about clericalization, about the role of the laity, about the so-called democratization of the church, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I really said, gosh, for 60 years or 50 years, whatever, we haven't made any progress. We're still stuck. Okay, that's the desolation. The moment of consolation was saying, yes, but the Spirit hasn't let go. The Spirit is still keeping us on this, because this is the Spirit's agenda. So the Synod is going to be a long process. I don't think I'll see the promised land, but I have every confidence that the Spirit is not going to let us off the hook, no matter how hard we try. So I think I can rest in a degree of consolation with the whole thing.
Thank you, James. Thank you so much for that whirlwind introduction. Great. And now I'm really pleased to invite Serena Nocetti, currently in Boston, I think in her last days in Boston, USA. Serena is a lay theologian, has been professor, or is professor at Religious Sciences Institute in Florence, and a teacher at the Theological Faculty of Central Italy. She's a founding member of the Association of Italian Women Theologians and former vice president of the Italian Theological Association. And Serena is going to really concretize the synodal theme for us in talking about an inclusive church and ministries, a reflection in gender perspective. Thank you, Serena.
Thank you for this invitation. And so, one of the fundamental topics under discussion at the Synod is undoubtedly the issues of ministries, because always in the history of the Church, every reform, every ecclesial reform, need a reform of ministries, of the theology of ministry, and the reform of church relationship. A synodal church is a church that lives of a communicative interaction between different subjects, men and women, lay people, and ordained minister. And there will be no reform of a missionary, a synodal church, if there is no reform of these ministries, without a reflection of the process of recognition of subjectuality of the all baptized, as Professor Hanvey explained. And without an open, free, courageous reflection of the dynamics of power and powers at plural in the church. The entire second part of the report, the synthesis of the October 23 assembly, is dedicated to the subject and to their specific contributions to the church. Subjects are obviously offer a differentiated contribution depending on their specific charisms and also their specific ministry for the church in the church, but also depending on their experience and of life and their skills and wisdom and so on. So the challenge of the Synodal Church is closely related to becoming truly a participatory church. As Professor Hanvey said, participation is one of the most important word perspective for this synod, I think. But this word, the third word in the title of the Synod 2021, it at least commented on. Compared to communion or mission, the other two words, it is not so commented. But in my opinion, it is decisive for the development of reflection and innovative ecclesial practice for the future of the Church. And two concepts are in the word participation. The first one is being part, and the second one is taking part. Being part, recognizing that other people are co-participating in the ecclesial body on the basis of the baptismal condition, but also taking part. And when we talk about taking part, I think we have to recognize that there is a process of empowerment of each subject. And also this entails that process that I would like to explain with the word entitlement, but in it at etymological level. As to explain, to have a titulus to do something, to have to be entitled to be something for an ecclesial and social context. This entitlement at etymological level depends on the permission each person gives himself or herself to take the floor and to share his or her experience, his or her wisdom, his or her reflection on life, and his or her understanding of the gospel today in this perspective. Depends on the duty and the responsibility each one assumes for the future of the church. Right and duty to sit at the synod table, not as a guest, but as a family members, and to enter in this conversation of the spirit in the spirit, not as a guest, but as a family members, God's family members. Entitlement depends on the recognition to others' ecclesial subject, and I think entitlement depends on the structural condition that guarantee real recognition and authentic participation to everybody in the church. Without exclusion, without preclusion, without a prejudice, recognizing how the Holy Spirit speak in these voices and through this voice. to listen to the unheard voices, unheard for centuries, denied in their value, denigrated, judged with appeal, or something simply left on the sidelines in the periphery of the church. So I think to make synod, to build a participatory church, inclusive church, entails this entering into a conversation. Etymological is con, with, but it's also towards, versus the other. I think that to make synod is to experience otherness, the value of infinity, many differences of culture, subjectuality, human experiences, experience of the other. But this opens, this process, this synodal process, opens up a through experience of the beyond. In Italian, it is a good play of words that this is one, esperienza dell'altro, esperienza dell'oltre. With the other, but versus it could develop a good process to go beyond. But I think there is a second thing, and not the conversation of this in the spirit, because synods are held because a decision has to be made on a debated topic on a specific pastoral issues. I think it is not sufficient conversation in the spirit, because I think we need a common discernment about some debated issues. So, synods are held because the church wants to go beyond the present, perceived as conflicting or limited or inadequate to our reality as ecclesial, we as ecclesial body. We would debate because we need a change. I think we have to look for a different method in this second assembly. So, among these the many topics, I would particularly like to highlight the reflection of women leaderships and ministries. I want to dwell on this because it seems to me that it gives us the indication of the challenges of reform, really concrete and debated reform, and the key elements of the debate about the church, as well as the way of synodal processes develop in a church that want to mature in participation, in inclusiveness. I think these key elements show how inner and structural resistances work in the church. When we debate about women, many resistances, cultural, stereotypical resistance, come on the scene. So, I think about this topic, the ideal reference reference horizon is that the all ministerial church, so the synthesis of Tauber explains, the only ministerial church is a community characterized de jure and not only de facto by a dynamic plurality of different subjects. Ordained ministries, instituted ministries, de facto ministries of laymen, laywomen, and so on. So, women in a clerical and androcentric church marked by a patriarchal culture, this is our church, and marked by structures that preserve this patriarchal system. Women in a kyriocentric and pyramidal church are the other par excellence. The women are often at the base of this ecclesial pyramid. And the synodal church is the one that lives, we know, from the interaction between one, some, or many, and all baptized. Women are part of the all baptized, can be part of the some, collaborators, but women do not participate today in the power of word of the one. The apostolicity of the faith and the serving of the church, the ecclesial we, today is without women. We can be part, but we cannot take part as the one in the church. It's interesting to note, first of all, how this topic about women in the church emerged in the Synod, because I think it helps us understand the potential of the synodal dynamic. I said so because in the preparatory document of the Synod, the topic, the theme of women was not there. There is two mentions, citing the encounter between Jesus and the Samaritan woman, between Jesus and the Canaanite woman, women who are not belong to the people of God, but there was no specific question of the women and the church for the future. In the preparatory document, there were not. So, sorry. When women took the floor at the synodal groups, the topic of women's participation in the life of the church and the recognition at different levels of their contribution immediately emerged. We are the majority of the participants of the synod, so it is obvious. The document, Widen Your Tent Space, devoted 7 paragraphs on the topic of women, and it does so by nothing the contribution of women world to the life of the church, a public, competent, authoritative world, but also by outlining the changes needed in women leadership for the ecclesial structures. Because there is often a glass ceiling. A few women have roles of authority in the church. A few are present where the guidelines and the strategy of the church life are decided now. Very few are present where priest and bishop are educated. So, with significant differences between different nations and continents, some women enters contest that for centuries were undisputed domain of clerical males only. But this happens in many cases by concession from above, and it's often a matter of entering in a labyrinth. You can up against the high walls, you find yourself stuck, you have to return to your starting point, you have devoured by those who, man or woman, want your place of authority. So the document goes deeper. It talks about leadership connected to ordained ministries. It recalls that many national synthesis have called for the ordination of women deacons, as the case of the Synod of Amazonia, and in some cases, the ordination of women to presbyterate is being considered. But this expression, the ordination of women to presbyterate, there are not more present in other document. It disappeared. So the 7 assembly at the synthesis of the continents reveal another element. There are differences linked to different cultures, and the role of women, the social recognition of their contribution, how men and women relate, sexual and gender differences are interpreted, we know, with the cultural categories. So I think it is an appeal, a challenge to overcome the logic of the church unity conceived on the basis of uniformitas, as Carolingian reform developed for Carolingian and Gregorian, but before Carolingian reform decided for the church. The October Assembly and the final synthesis further focuses and debated this time. It seemed to me that a truth often denied, underestimated, emerges. The church is a sex gender system. The calls for women leadership and ministerial ordination foreground these. We must recognize the dynamics of sexual differentiation as they are constructed and maintained in gender perspective with gender languages, and how gender differences is culturally and ritually liturgical interpreted and lived. In a synodal church, there is a power of a world of professional faith that pays through the symbolization of our faith experience, which is lived in gender sarks, gender's bodies, and is perceived, described through a symbolic and linguistic order qualified according to gender. So, as Professor James Hamby said, a cardinal principle of synodality is the participation of all the baptized in sensus fidei, and the synod develops in the form of maturation or building a consensus fidelium. So I think every time we have a transmission of this gospel profession of the faith in the church, every time is a reaffirmation transformed through the unique and personal stories of every subject, man, women, everybody in the church. So the contribution of women is first and foremost the contribution of a word interpreting and reinterpreting the faith, especially if it is placed from a perspective that of gender, that brings that these ideas are always a culturally defined form of understanding of the human. I think the debate about the ordination of women is an appeal to unveil and to deconstruct those falsely no-through neutral ecclesiologies and liturgies. Our liturgies, our ecclesiologies are anchored to an idea. No unthinking masculinity. We must to debate a real taboo topic, the relationship between masculinity, Mannheim, power, and sacred. We need to break out of gender stereotypes, primarily those related to recourse to the Marian and Petrine principle, in order to think not a woman church or church as woman, but to think to be an ecclesial we together, men and women, all baptized. We must approach the question who we are called to be as church from a dialogue, multidirectional perspective, and especially with no static canons of sane identity, because are always selective. We need anthropological perspective rooted in dynamic of recognition and interaction, recognizing that we need a reciprocal hospitality as legitimate diners at those synodal tables. Expected because we are capable of bringing the human being, the Christian being, in a different way from my partial approach. But I think it is necessary we have to have an experience of this partiality.
And you
So,
begin to
to
conclude.
conclude, yes,
Yeah,
so
thank
sorry.
you
In
enough.
the Roman Catholic Church, the ordained ministry of bishop, priest, and deacons is constitutive. It's not the priestly and sacral interpretation that has been made for centuries in different social and cultural contexts, ecclesial contexts. We must be overcome with the structural reform of the ministry, because the ordained ministry always have a functional dimension and symbolic dimension. So I think the best way is debate about diaconate, because according to the Second Vatican II, the diaconate is no priestly ordained ministries. I would say this could help us to deconstruct a sacral and a priestly image of the ministry that Tridentine tradition still refers us. More immediately, I would say that the time has come to think about the ordination of women to diaconate, because this interrupts, regenerates, and builds a new choreography in the ecclesial body, not sacerdotal ministry, not priestly ministry, not sacral ministry, but a different church of women and men together.
Thank you, Serena. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And sorry for my long expression,
No,
my long
wonderful.
speech.
And we will have the text of Serena's presentation that we hopefully we can circulate. Thank you. And now I'm very happy to introduce Helena Jepson Spula. Helena was a de has been a delegate and will be a delegate, we hope, in October 2024. Helena works for the Swiss Catholic aid organization Fast in Action, with responsibility for the Philippines and Asia in general. As I've said, she was a Swiss delegate at the European Assembly in Prague and a representative of Europe at the Global Synodal Assembly in Rome. She has positioned herself in favour of women's ordination and LGBTI plus equality. And so over to you, Helena, for your remarks. As a delegate's view, what hopes are there for synodal reform and renewal in the church?
Thank you, Martin. Thanks also to your group for inviting me to share my experience of this, yeah, very historic bishop synod for the first time with lay, although I don't like the expression, but we were, of course, a certain number of lay people who were full members with the right to vote at this bishop synod, which was really remarkable. And I still remember the opening of the synod. You know, we were together, especially the women, the 54 women also. Also, yeah, we felt this historic moment that the church was like opening up and entering into, I think, a new mode of being church. What is very important for me for this synod is what Father James also mentioned before, is that this synod is a process. Because we have been starting two years ago with the consultation of our people here in Switzerland and in all the countries of the world, this process of listening to the people, taking up their themes and concerns and bringing it to the different levels of our church is for this. In my life in Switzerland, I have never experienced, for example, although we are quite a participatory church in many dioceses of Switzerland, but this process that me, I learned it from the Amazonia Synod. It's a systematic consultation of the people and bringing back the results also of a synodal assembly to the people is wonderful and learning for me. And I think it can be really a future way of being church. What is remarkable for me, and I still remember very well, is a year ago, the European Synodal Assembly in Prague, where I met some of you. My colleague Tatiana, who was another Swiss delegate, we met with the LGBT group right before the synod. We were nervous, you know, because of this European Assembly. We were members there. We came with a very good message from the Swiss church, but we were nervous to share it and in the Synodal Assembly there. And when we met with you there before, and we had this wonderful liturgy also with you, we went back and we said, maybe this was the highlight of Prague for us. Emotionally, it was really the highlight because we felt community with you. We felt we are bringing also your concerns to this assembly. So what I want to say also for the synod assemblies in Rome, it is and it was important for me and it will be important that you are also present there. And something I would like to achieve, and I'm working for it with others also, that the inside and outside of the synod in Rome can be closer together, like what we experienced during the Amazonia Synod. In October last year, the LGBT plus group, for example, for me, it was very far. It had to do with our very busy schedule also. But it was wonderful to meet some of you, but you were too far for us. So that's one of my objectives also. I would like to be closer in touch with the groups that are also there in Rome during the synod. And I find it important that you are also there. For me, a very important experience of this synod, maybe the most important one, was to see and to experience that we are a universal church. I think we experienced it and we realized this very diverse church with all our experiences, living in the same church, but in different contexts. We brought very different experiences to this assembly. And for me, that was a very strong experience to feel we are actually so diverse and we are such a colorful church, you know, worldwide. So Can we maybe also take it as a message? I mean, inside our church, that we are a colorful church and we don't have to be afraid of this diversity, because we are still united, and diversity is actually a wonderful thing in our church. So let's appreciate it and learn from it also. From this experience that we actually learn from each other and we are journeying together. I think during this synod, the lay people there, let's say the non-bishops and cardinals, they made a difference in this bishops' synod. One of the old cardinals, Cardinal Schönborn, said, I have experienced many synods. He said, I think I remember 11 or 12 when he was still a young theologian. He was there. But this was for him the most impressive, because he said the people of God were represented better than in previous synods. So, and I think the way we had to work, or we used to work during this synod with this also conversation in the spirit and around the tables, the group around, made a big difference. I mean, it's somehow a small thing, but it had a big impact on the way we talk to each other in our groups. So we were really at the same like level with cardinals, professors for theology. And well, for the lay and for the women, it was a bit difficult, because we were in groups like me, for example, in my first group, an Italian speaking group, we were a sister from Iraq and myself, and then cardinals, heads of dicasteries. So we felt like, oh my goodness, how can we speak in these groups, you know? But also the professional moderation of the groups was so helpful to really speak in this freedom of the spirit, you know, to others. There was a point when we felt so bad, the sister and me, because some members were like questioning, for example, the idea, is this really a bishop's synod if we have lay people voting here together with us? Is this really a bishop's synod? And we were there. We have been working for this synod for the past 2 years or more. And we brought the experiences of our people in our countries and continents. So we felt bad. And during the break, we said, we have to have the courage, you know, to really say that, to really say that we are also there. And we bring the experiences of our communities. Me, I'm from Switzerland, the sister from Iraq, you know. So we dare to say it, because also the facilitator of the group was helping and supporting us. And that was a wonderful experience, because some of those who questioned the idea of this bishop synod with lay, they said, oh, really? You feel bad? I mean, that was only, they realized it only then. So this conversation in the spirit and the professional moderation helped us a lot. The idea that this synod is a process was also, we could feel it during the synod. I mean, we were like realizing better and better during the synodal assembly, oh, it's a process. We can even influence this synodal assembly. For example, one difficulty for me was, me, I'm not a theologian. I'm a catechist, and I used to teach. I used to do a lot of pastoral work with young people. I used also to do liturgies, but I'm not a theologian. I'm not a professor for theology. So, but we knew there is a group of theological experts there, but they did not speak in the assembly. I mean, we could ask them for advice, but then in the group, it was difficult to agree that we invite them to our table, because actually here we don't agree with each other. So during the synod, we talked to the experts and we talked to the synod office and said, can it be that the theological expert also probably give inputs, or they try to, because they were listening to our discussion, to summarize and then to reflect also from their perspective. And because it was a process, and because the synod office is supporting this process so much, you know, they changed. And there were a number of theological inputs who took up the discussion of the synod assembly, and it was so helpful. to bring our discussions further. I'm so thankful to this idea, and I realized myself we are not used to be to work in these processes. We are not used to it yet, huh? It was a wonderful experience. It's not easy, huh? Also, I feel it in Switzerland. We come back and the processes, we bring back the synthesis report, we discuss it again. This process goes on and on. And that's also not easy to tell the people here, because we actually really need results of the Synod of October 24, because with some concerns here, we see there need to be pastoral solutions for them. So there is also this kind of pressure and need to really that we need some changes. But the process of this synod is, for me, it's a wonderful thing. And I think we can learn. Our church is learning from this. The Swiss report we brought to Prague to the European Assembly, and also our report that we made regarding the working document for the synod in October included the most, I just would just like to tell you the three most important points were unity in diversity, meaning decentralizing or having more regional probably solutions in our church. That was one concern we brought to the synod, and Bishop Felix and me and from the European and the Swiss level, we brought them into the synod and the role of the women. And the third point is radical inclusion of all the people in our church, where the LGBT plus theme is also there. And it's very important for the church in Switzerland. I mean, we see that now it's there we need pastoral solutions. So we brought it into the synod assembly. My a very deep experience of this synod, I did not expect this synod that courageous. The synod, the discussions were really courageous. You cannot see it in the synthesis document because it's a synod, a synthesis document. But they were really, for me, the spirit was working. People were talking openly, cardinals, really openly, bishops, not only the lay, but the women were strong. Of course, the women were very strong because the 54 women there were women leaders, like a sister with the head of all the religions in India. I mean, these are high profile women and they dare to speak. But I did not expect cardinals to speak that courageously on many issues. And all the issues were there. That was also like, for me, like a miracle. I didn't expect that we would talk about inclusion, also the role of the women with that openness. I'm deeply thankful for all the groups who are participating. And so I would be so thankful if you could give feedback to the synthesis report so that it comes in, it will come into the next working document for the next synod. So we need all your feedbacks really. And all the exchanges I had, for example, with I had a, such a wonderful experience with a group from Italy called Tre volte genitori, three times parents. This group of, I think, 300 parents of queer children. And that was so impressive to me. And I had prepared it for my inputs during the synod, because this perspective of Catholic parents, with queer children, I mean, that was something. It was easily to bring in into the group discussion. So I did not have all these contacts. I'm so thankful for all of you who came to us so that we could bring your voices into the synod. And yeah, thank you so much for being part of this adventure.
Right. Thank you, Helena. And now for some concluding responses. It's wonderful to introduce Georgina Adhiambo from Kenya. Georgina is a human rights activist, mainly working with sexual and gender minority women, and is the executive director of Voices of Women in Western Kenya. She fights for the rights of LGBTQ women in rural areas of Western Kenya. She's a great fighter for women's rights in Western Kenya and has fought for the rights of women and more so the lesbian, bisexual, and queer women in Western Kenya for at least for the last 15 years. And Jordinia was also a member of the original steering group, which led to the formation of the Global Network of Rainbow Catholics. So, welcome to Jordinia from Kenya.
Thank you so much, everyone who's here. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon to you all. I'm so grateful and looking at my response after my seniors have talked, I think it is a great initiative that I add the activist voice in this space. I'm a Catholic, I'm and a lesbian Catholic. That one I would say freely. So that I talk on the context of being a Catholic. I think as an LGBT person, a queer person in Kenya, there's a lot of issues that we really face. Looking at all that have been said about the synod, it makes me ask very many questions. Is there a role that the bishops in Africa follow, or they are also following their own doctrine? The doctrine, is it from the Rome space, or is it doctrines that are being made by our African bishops, African clergy? Why do I say so? As an activist, you normally like giving a real scenario. On Ash Wednesday, when I went to church, and then the priest was giving the sermon, then the priest goes further to say, during the time of Lent, let us focus on the fourth week of Lent that talks about family. Then he started talking about how we need to bring on issues of family, how we need to protect the family. Then comes in and says, we don't need gay relationship. We don't, we need, we are condemning gay relationship. We are condemning gay marriages. You look at that context, we are in land that has the context of love, that has the context of prayers and fasting. Then a priest brings that on board as a queer Catholic. Don't you think my Lent, if I'm not having that strong faith, my Lent period has just been destroyed with that preaching? Why should I listen, go to church, be praying when a priest who is in charge of the flock is making such a statement? That's why I ask this question. Are the bishops, the African bishops, having a different preaching faith? Because when we look at what Pope is bringing on board, inclusion, Pope has just requested, can we bless? Because the context of the queer people in church should not even hinder you from preaching, because you don't know all of them. They've come to church too for prayers. But here you are condemning them. Why are you condemning them? Because look at Jesus. Jesus went to the sex worker who was being stoned. So when he asked those questions, Jesus was bringing the flock together. But clergy are brought to bring the flocks together. So when we start condemning and ensuring that we are talking about against the queer people, then we are also putting their lives in danger, because you talk about we are condemning same-sex relationship. Yes, you are condemning same-sex relationship, but within the congregation, there are people who identify as same-sex relationship. And they're living in spaces where people know them as queer people. Then you're putting their lives in danger. At the same time, you're preaching humanity. You're preaching love. And you've already set someone to be in a war zone to face violence. So when you look at all this, the clergy, how do they want to work in a space that they also follow? If you look at I love the concept of Serena, when Serena said that gender inclusion, I have been battling with that context. Because you find in Africa, there's a lot of patriarchy. Yeah. We find our sisters within the Catholic Church. We find we have a professor. But you look at in colleges, in universities, even in hospitals where the Catholic Church is running all this, the humanitarian space, you find a college is being run, a university is being run by a father who has not even gone to school, who has not completed that professional education, but a sister who has master's in different subjects is being put as a mother superior. I feel that is biased. Yeah. We need to give a voice to the sisters within the convent. Also, as much as we are bringing in the lay women, but the sisters in the convent need to have a voice. And they need to be put in a space that their voices can also be heard and respected too. You find in Africa the context also of that gender inclusion. When issues of family planning is being talked about, it is the bishops who are men, the priests who are talking about family planning, talking about my body as a woman. Yeah? The women are not, there's not that participation. They are saying we are not accepting family planning in the Catholic Church. You're not considering this person who you are representing, you're talking on her behalf, to be having issues. Yeah. So I think those context needs to also be looked into. When you also look at the synod, when Professor Hanvi was talking about the issues of the synod, listening, accompanying, and also bringing on board, how do we work toward, it is a working process. As much as it is a working process, how do we ensure there is inclusion of the LGBT person within the synod? Let's say, for example, our clergies in Africa are the ones really against what the Pope is talking about, inclusion of LGBT, yeah? So how do we work towards ensuring more Catholic LGBT activists from Africa come to the synod so that there is that lived reality that we are part and parcel of the human space, even in Africa. That notion of homosexuality is an African, is an Christian, should be removed so that we change the narrative. How do we change that narrative of inclusion? Looking at the report, it is also a way how, and Helena said, how do we bring more people, more voices, yeah, to the synod? So that as much as the Pope is supporting, how do we as the Catholic Church ensure that we give the Pope support to continue bringing everybody, all the excluded persons to the church? Because the church is a space, a space where everyone needs a spiritual nourishment. Everyone needs to be closer to their God. Yeah? How do we, as people who we're talking about the Eucharist, that put us together with Christ, how do we get involved to be a space that we bring the flock together as Christians, as Catholics, so that we don't have the African Catholic clergy saying, no, we are not accepting the blessing of LGBT. Then you ask yourself, when I, as Georgina, go to receive the Holy Eucharist, is it written on my face that I'm an LGBT? It's not. But the priest has blessed me. Yeah? So how do we work together? The people who feel they have been they're being sent away by how our priests preach, to be brought closer to God. They come to church. Because if you look at Kenya now, there is the context of bill that is being taken to parliament. It is called a family protection bill that is talking against LGBT, all the organizations that are supporting them. Even if you are living in a house and you're paying rent and the landlord knows that you are a queer person, that person is also to be taken to prison. So you look at such laws. Do we really need to go that far? Yeah. We are talking about love. We are talking about humility. But you are segregating a certain section of people because of their gender, because of their orientation. Yeah. Because we are not having that context of learning. So I think as the Catholic Church, as the members of different spaces, we need to even have start having conversation even with the congregation. Catholic Church has so many groupings within the church. So how do we start having a lot of sensitization, bringing on board? How do we work together as people? These are children. These are your children, because you're trying to take them away, to segregate them, but you are part and parcel of this person's life, because maybe this is your mother, this is your father, and all that. So how do we ensure that we work together as a church, as a members of the Catholic Church, to be in a space where there is inclusion, yeah, no matter what? So in conclusion, I think we need to work together from all the continent where the Catholics are, to ensure that we have a stronger voice within the Synod. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Georgina. That's wonderful.
Thank you for listening in. My name is Michael Sechen. This podcast is made in partnership with the European Forum of LGBT Christian Groups. The next episode is gonna come soon. Thank you for listening at this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. There are going to be more episodes that follow the webinars on the relevance of the synodal process for LGBTI plus people. Stay tuned and look out for the next episodes. Until then, bye everyone.